We now know what Jay Powell is thinking. What, though, does it mean? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'm not in Los Angeles. I'm in Washington, D.C. one more time. Sorry. It is Friday the 13th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I don't know about y'all, but as you just heard, I have had a week, as has, to be clear, this whole economy. So we're going to get right to it. Gina Smilek's at the New York Times. Jordan Holman is at Bloomberg. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me go to you first. We heard yesterday on this program, Jay Powell say, not that necessarily 75 basis points was completely back on the table, 0.75 percentage point of an interest rate increase for the Fed, but it was certainly less off the table, I think, than we had surmised it to be. And I wonder what you, as the actual experienced Fed watcher on this panel, made of that.
Yeah, I would say we got a pretty clear not off the table signal yesterday in your interview. I thought it was really interesting because, you know, Chair Powell, just to rewind for listeners, Chair Powell had last Wednesday after his press, after the Fed's decision, gone out in his press conference and basically said, you know, 75 basis points, 0.75 percentage point, that kind of a big move, it's just not under active consideration now. And I think what you saw after that was a whole range of sort of the Wall Street commentariat coming out and saying, you know, why would they take this off the table? That's crazy. They should, everything should be on the table. Inflation's crazy high. And it seems like, you know, over the past week, we've seen a lot of Chair Powell's colleagues kind of walk back that 75 basis point not being, you know, even under consideration comment. And then I think yesterday with his clarification, it became clear that what he was trying to tell us was, we're not doing this now, not we're not doing this never. And so I think that's definitely sort of reigniting attention to this conversation.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's what I took from it too. Jordan, he did say, though, that that soft landing that he is after and that the Fed is really working at is subject to a whole lot of things that are not under his control. And that obviously complicates his challenge.
Absolutely. I mean, the supply and demand issue, the supply chain crisis, that's still not abated. Those are things, obviously, he can't control, but those are things that are also showing up in everyday people's lives. Higher prices that retailers are now passing on to consumers, just the difficulty of getting merchandise to shores is leading to folks having to switch up, you know, what they might purchase compared to what they want to purchase. And so it just, I guess, shows the interconnectedness of the economy, even if, you know, it's not, the buck doesn't stop there for him. There's other things that are influencing the way he's thinking about his decisions.
So I'm not going to play what is Jay Powell thinking, because we know what is Jay Powell thinking. But Gina, let me ask you this, right? Inflation comes out this week. The CPI comes out and it's, you know, a touch down, but there are some worrying indicators in there. It's a pretty clear indication that it's going to be a while. Whether the landing is soft or hard, it's not coming soon.
Right. I think that the touchdown was the only piece of good news in this report. It was generally a bad news report, I would say, because I think what we really saw here is that underlying inflation pressures remain really strong. You know, the sort of core indexes, core services in particular, so sort of rents, wage, all the wage sensitive categories, those are moving up pretty sharply. And those are the ones that are really hard to wrestle under control. So I think we're in a situation where you could definitely see inflation starting to fade. You are probably going to see inflation starting to fade. But there's a big difference between fading from 8.5%, which is where we were in March, and fading back to 2%, which is where we want to be. So I think that's a big gap. And this report said it might take a really long time to get there.
Gina, let me ask you this, though. What do you make of the shift that we are seeing in inflation moving from goods, right, because we've all been buying stuff, now to services, and we're seeing inflation happening there? Gina, what do you make of that?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if you're J Powell, that has got to worry you, because what we know about goods prices is they're a little bit bouncier. They've, you know, historically been actually in deflation for a lot of the sort of pre-pandemic mm-hmm. 2 decades. Services prices are kind of where it's at. They make up a much bigger part of the economy. They move much more slowly. They are not bouncy. When they go up, they tend to keep going up. And so I think that the fact that those are going up, it is really do suggest that some of these inflationary pressures might be becoming more permanent. And from the Fed's perspective, and I think from the White House's perspective, that is what you don't want to see happening.
Yeah, the White House is a whole different deal. Cecilia Rouse, by the way, the head of the CEA at the White House, coming up a little bit later in the program. Jordan, let me get to consumers and retail and inflation, which is a toxic brew, right? Consumer sentiment came out today. It's terrible, the worst in 10 years. Retailers have some pricing power. They're sometimes using it, sometimes not. What do you make of the you know, near-term landscape for that?
Yeah, so retailers definitely are feeling more comfortable saying they have pricing power. For investors, that's great. For folks who are trying to just buy something, that's not. But also, one thing to listen to is what retailers aren't saying they're going to take price on. So take Old Navy. Last week, they said that we won't raise prices on kids' clothing until the end of the back-to-school year, which is great. You know, parents have to think about that. But what they didn't say is that they might raise prices on a whole bunch of other categories. Right. And so that's what's happening in the mind of retail CEOs, thinking about what are places that people definitely would feel the pinch when it comes to higher prices and where they won't. And then the other thing to Gina's point about where inflation is still a big issue with the rents and whatnot, people will then pull back on things that they will see, like, I don't need to buy that new dress, or maybe I don't need to buy a big refrigerator right now. And that's going to also be concerning to retailers.
Jordan Holman at Bloomberg and Gina Smilek at the New York Times with the week that was. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, the volatility, well, it decided to be to the downside, the upside, rather. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I told you, I've had a tough week. There's a market research firm out there called DataSembly that came out with a number this week that is getting a whole lot of play. 43% of the baby formula that is usually available in this economy isn't right now. It's just out of stock. As with any large-scale shortage, of course, there are a lot of issues at play here. But things started getting tight with formula a couple of months ago after a recall by Abbott, one of the main producers of infant formula in this country. That plant is still closed. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, this is a market challenge that is not going to be easily fixed.
Just 4 companies produce almost all of the baby formula in the U.S.
It's been this way for decades. We've had large manufacturers that have consistently commanded the market space and edged out the competition.
Brian Dittmeyer at the National WIC Association says when you only have a few companies that make something, this is one of the risks.
You wind up with a situation where one plant closing for the matter of a few weeks has this ripple effect throughout the entire industry.
And it's particularly dire with something like baby formula that's a necessity and that doesn't have substitutes.
There are many infants that can only tolerate one or maybe 2 types of formula.
Carrie Chan at Columbia Business School says some parents can easily switch their babies to any brand of formula that's available, but some can't. They need specific kinds for health reasons.
And so when there's a shortage in that area, there's not a possibility to just switch to an alternative.
So far, U.S. companies have not been able to ramp up manufacturing quickly enough to meet the need.
The formula supply chain is very similar to the supply chain of other products.
Ala Valente at Forrester says there's also another barrier to getting more supply on shelves quickly.
In the U.S., we have restrictions on the import of baby formula.
The Biden administration says it's taking steps to make it easier to import baby formula from abroad as one way to help increase supply in the short term. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
All right, this is a tricky turn to make, baby formula to cryptocurrencies, but there is a certain level of market dysfunction common to both. You've seen the headline, surely. Hundreds of billions of dollars in losses across cryptocurrencies. The collapse of something called Terra USD. That's an algorithmic stablecoin that is supposed to be stable, but clearly is not. And then Coinbase, one of the leading crypto exchanges, revealing in a regulatory filing this week that if they go bankrupt, depositors could just lose all the crypto they've got in their Coinbase accounts. As Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports from here in Washington, the word people are starting to use more and more is regulation.
When it comes to crypto, there is a distinct whiff of "I told you so" in certain circles. That disclosure by Coinbase is only one reason.
It struck me that they should have said it a long time ago, because it's absolutely true.
Timothy Massad, former head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, says a lot of people learned the hard way this week that Coinbase and so much else in crypto isn't regulated by the federal government.
It just shows how volatile this asset class is. There are essentially no fundamentals.
But there is so much to potentially regulate. Lee Reiners is with Duke Law.
And the question is, which agency should be given authority?
Massad's old agency, the CFTC, is one possibility. Another is the Securities and Exchange Commission, where Hester Peirce is a commissioner. In an interview with Marketplace, she said the SEC has a lot of authority, but hasn't used it to set what she calls rules of the road.
At this stage, it would make a lot of sense to spend some of those regulatory resources on thinking about a reasonable framework for crypto.
A reasonable framework, not a crackdown. Even after this week.
You can't just say when something bad happens, we're going to try to shut down the whole thing.
Peirce says until now, her agency has been regulating by enforcing rules that don't exist. When they are made, she says both consumer protection advocates and the crypto industry should be involved. In Washington, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we needed the public sector to be able to step in.
One does wonder how that worked out. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 434 today, 3.8%, 11,805. The S&P 500 up 93 points, about 2.3%, 4,023. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 466 points, 1.4%, 32.196 there. For the week, though, the NASDAQ lost 2.8%, the S&P 500 down 2.4%, Dow subtracted 2.1%. But back to today, shall we? Companies that help drive stocks higher include those in the bruised and battered tech sector. Alphabet found 2.8%, Netflix surged 7.6%, Amazon up about 5.7%. Bond prices fell, yield on the 10-year Treasury note 2.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We spent the program yesterday, as I might have mentioned a time or two, mostly with Fed Chair Jay Powell, but also with a brief tour to the White House for a conversation with Cecilia Rouse, the chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. And in a way, they're complementary interviews, right? Monetary economic policy from the Federal Reserve, political economic policy from inside the White House. Anyway, here you go. Dr. Rouse, welcome to the program. Nice to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You have been an economist for a very long time, and you've been in and out of government for a very long time. And we are dealing with something in this economy now that we haven't seen in a long time, and that you, by which really I mean the president, can't do much to control. And I wonder how that makes you feel.
Well, that's a good question. I will tell you, here's how I feel.
Yeah.
We have been through a really tough 2 years. At the beginning of this pandemic, when we told everybody to stay home, we wanted them not to work. We wanted them not to go to grocery stores, although we wanted them to be able to eat and pay their rent. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to power down our economy. That struck me as the time when we needed to understand that there was an important role for government at that moment. The private sector, we needed it to step back. We needed the public sector to be able to step in. Congress acted with unbelievable speed in passing the CARES Act, didn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It was not a perfect law, but it did what it needed to do. It got money into people's pockets. It tried to save businesses. Fast forward, President Biden comes into office. We still don't know where we are in the pandemic. We know we have vaccines that in the lab look effective. We don't know if they'll reduce transmission. We don't know how long the protection lasts. We don't know if we can get the shots into arms. The American Rescue Plan has passed. It provides additional help for households, additional help for businesses, state and local governments, because we didn't know what their balance sheets would look like.
Yeah.
And importantly, it underwrote the strategy against the pandemic. As a result, we had the fastest growth in almost 40 years. Households were able to spend.
However, let me interrupt you here for just a second and ask you whether because of the American Rescue Plan and all the trillions of dollars that were spent, we are now in some ways bearing the inflation consequences of that. That is to say, does the Biden administration bear some of the responsibility for where inflation is today?
Here's what I will say, is if you look around the world at advanced countries that did what we did, which said we need to support our households, we need to support our businesses, we have to support our economy through this, we see inflation. Because while demand was supported, the supply could not support that demand. Inflation is fundamentally a mismatch between demand and supply. So if you want to say, did the Biden administration, by helping people get through this pandemic in a way that they were able to stay in their homes, have jobs, have household balance sheets, even among those in the lower part of our income distribution that are stronger than they were before the pandemic, did that cause some of the inflation? Yes, and we are with our other countries. It's part and parcel of the pandemic. We powered down a $22, $23 trillion economy, and we can't just power it back up without some consequence.
Let me ask you about the president and the speech he gave on Tuesday about inflation and the efforts that you and his administration are making. Pretty clear that he's going directly to the American people because he understands not only the political risks, but also the economic risks to everybody out there. Do you think he's getting through? I ask because people feel terrible about this economy. The underlying economy is good, right? Jobs are strong. There's some growth. You know, last quarter was terrible, but there's growth on the horizon. But people still feel lousy.
Absolutely, and the president understands that because inflation affects everybody. You go to the grocery store, you feel it. You go to the gas station, and you feel it. And he understands that. He comes from a family where this kind of inflation would really hurt and cause a lot of anxiety every night. So you're right. He's trying to have his economic team go out and explain that he really is focused on this. This is first and foremost the purview of the Federal Reserve. And it is a wonderful thing that at least three of the four current nominees have now been confirmed. Mm-hmm. And he respects their independence. But, you know, we welcome the fact that they are now changing their policy stance towards how they're addressing the price stability mandate versus the full employment mandate.
Let me go back to the president's speech the other day. He made a point, I think, a couple of times in that speech of calling out corporations for what he called price gouging. And I guess my question is, do you really think that companies making profits are responsible for inflation in this economy?
Well, here's what we know about companies is that their profit margins, so that's looking at what they're taking in minus their costs, are almost at record highs, that they increase, especially after tax, that they increased something like 14.5% last year. And so companies have a choice. When they are making those kinds of profit margins, they can, you know, lower prices, increase wages, they can pay their shareholders. The president believes they should be paying their fair share in taxes. He has proposed increasing the corporate tax rate because I noticed I said that it's their after-tax profit margins mm-hmm. that have increased, and that's largely due to the 2017 tax cut.
Tax policy aside, you didn't really answer the question. Do you think companies are responsible for inflation in this economy?
Well, we have a longstanding problem with concentration in this country. And we know that that economies that are more, or sectors that are more concentrated, that they have higher price levels. And that's bad for an innovation. That's bad for workers if it's more monopsonized. So the president has had a whole of government approach to address competition and to try to improve competition in our economy. So we know that that's a long-standing problem and we need to be addressing it.
You talked about the role of the public and the private sector in this economy as we started this conversation. And in the economic report of the president that came out last month, you guys spent a lot of time on that very issue. One of the things that became clear as the Biden administration took over is that he and you and I imagine as other economic advisors have a more expansive vision of the role of government in this economy. And I guess my question out of that is, given inflation and the challenges that poses right now, and whatever's happening with his Build Back Better agenda, which, to be completely honest, I've lost track with, and you're kind of shrugging, right? Is his domestic policy, not agenda, but his aspiration, is that now fundamentally dialed back?
You have completely identified what I was the heart and soul of the economic report of the president, which was that over the last 3 decades or so, our federal government has been following a policy of saying the private sector can solve all problems. In Economics 101, we teach our students that the private sector has many, many virtues, but that there are certain problems that it does not solve very well. That's what we tried to emphasize in the economic report of the president, where there are what we call externalities, where my actions are going to impact not just me, but you, such as in a pandemic. If I'm sick and I go to the store and I make everybody else sick, that's a problem. I believe that, and this president is focused on policies that really go to where there is what we call market failures. So the bipartisan infrastructure law, not a small accomplishment by this administration, a really important investments in infrastructure, which have some of those qualities. The private sector doesn't do a very good job of investing in roads and bridges because they can't fully recoup the benefits of their investments there. Another part of the president's agenda is investments in human capital, because that's another part of our infrastructure, really. If I don't have adequate childcare or home care, I cannot go to work. And we know that the country benefits if I'm able to go to work. Right now, if we talk about some of our challenges in our economy, labor supply has come back very robustly mm-hmm. in the last year, but we still know that we have room to grow. We still need more people who are in the labor force looking for work. And for some of those people, it's very difficult to do so without adequate childcare.
Let me try to go another way at that question and get a, with all possible respect, a better answer out of you. To what extent do you think the political polarization in this society, and I don't want to get into the politics of it, right, because that's not our remit here. What extent do you think the political polarization in our society, but also on Capitol Hill, obviously, is impeding what President Biden wants to do with this economy?
I think we've got a country right now where there have been winners and losers. This is seen very clearly with our increasing income inequality mm-hmm. and wealth inequality. And that is part of the challenge that President Biden actually wants to try to address. He wants to have an economy in which we have economic growth, and he wants that economic growth to be more widely shared, whether that's by race and ethnicity, by rural, urban, different parts of the country. He feels in particular for the former workers in manufacturing who have really suffered because those jobs have gone away. He wants to have good paying jobs so that people have a reason to get up in the morning. They have a purpose in their lives, and they can support their families with good paying jobs that reflect a hard day's work. So I do believe that some of this polarization reflects the fact of the increasing income inequality, and we need to have policies that help to redress that.
Dr. Ross, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, I tried not to talk about this today. I really did, but I honestly, I kind of have to. Maybe you saw this morning, that Elon Musk is putting his acquisition of Twitter temporarily on hold, his words, while he looks into something or other about the company he's already signed a contract to buy for $44 billion. Anyway, here is my actual final thoughts. Putting deals like this on hold? That's not a thing. All right, we've got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. A report this week from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that global wheat production is going to fall this year for the first time in 4 years. The big and honestly not at all surprising data point is that Ukrainian wheat production is going to be down 35% from a year ago. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.